Good morning. On the subject of culture, which is today's topic, you've been listening to a Lubbock group called the Flatlanders. Anybody know of these guys? The Flatlanders? Nobody? They grew up in Lubbock in the 50s, had separate music careers, and have started playing again later in their lives. The lead singer is a guy named Jimmy Dale Gilmore, and his voice has been described as he sounds like what Willie Nelson would sound like if Willie Nelson could sing. So I think that's kind of clever. But they are they're a group of West Texas originals, and if you have any interest in that type of music or are inclined to learn a little bit more about it, the Flatlanders will be in Lubbock 2 weeks from tomorrow at the Cactus Theater downtown. They get here once or twice a year, and I was introduced to them early on when I moved to Lubbock, and we just see them every time they're here. They're getting up in years now, so time is getting short. So if that's your deal, 2 weeks from Friday. All right, here's the thing about today. I have been under the weather all week. Maybe you noticed I wasn't at full strength on Tuesday, and I'm not any better. So I'm going to give you the cliff notes of the culture lecture today. It's going to run about a half hour. And I have also posted the full, you know, embellished, repeat the stuff, ask for questions piece that I used in this class last spring. So that lecture, the audio from that lecture is already online, and I'll post this shortened version as well. And then when we're done with this, I'll be in my office for a little while if anybody has any questions that I can clear up. So fair enough? Okay. Let me talk about what culture is. I mean, it's not that hard to describe because it's a way of describing everything. A culture, whether it's your culture, the United States, another country, we study it in terms of what people learn, what people teach, what they do. So everything we do, everything we learn, everything we teach illustrates to others and reinforces in ourselves what our culture is about. What is it that's uniquely American? I mean, the answer to that question would be elements of American culture. What is it that's uniquely Texan, even within America? In general, we divide our understanding of culture into two things, the material world and the non-material world. I mean, we have Red Raider colors for, you know, the material representation of Texas Tech, the double T or something like that. Jewelry, buildings, the kinds of things that architecture would be another example of that. Barbecue, which, by the way, is very different in Texas than North Carolina, than Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, it's non-existent to speak of. On the other hand, I don't know who figured out how to do what they do with brisket down here. And if it wasn't for this week, I'd be having some for lunch. So anyway, also non-material culture, the things we believe, the things we cherish, the things we value. You know, what is it that's uniquely American? And I'll get to that here in a little bit. There's also this element of cultural diffusion that I think is kind of interesting. That's the exporting of culture. In an internet world now where you've literally got the whole world in your hands, it's hard to say that we are bounded by American, even American technology. Or certainly ethnic foods or anything like that, because we have crossed most boundaries through diffusion. All right, the elements of culture I want to stress, the first being language, because it's by far the most important. It is the foundational element of every culture. Every people, every grouping of people for all time and through all time have used their voices to communicate. Now, not always through the construction of an alphabet and the making of words and so on. But vocal communication or verbal communication is as old as people are. This is what we figured out how to do. Written communication, interestingly enough, is only about 5,000 years old. And much of what we have reported to us that occurred in the Old Testament, especially in the earliest portions, occurred earlier than anybody on earth was writing stuff down, as it were. So a lot of what we have in any sacred text, whether it's the Old Testament or any other, is the product of initially a whole lot of sort of oral tradition that came down first before anything was written down. And we'll talk more about that kind of thing at another time. A couple of interesting features about language. One is that it not only describes reality, but it also determines, in one sense, what reality would be. Let me just give you an example. I'm going to hypothetically recite what might be the opening paragraph in a textbook on Doctoring 101. When preparing to conduct a physical examination, the physician first examines the case history of his patient. He then takes the blood pressure, looks in the ears. He then examines the blood report, palpates the abdomen, and then he gives an assessment. Okay? That's not probably how they're written, but you get the idea. If you were listening carefully, you may have noticed that I made an assumption about every single doctor conducting every single physical every single time. And that is, they're all men. I said, he does that, does this. He checks his patient's history, his story, right? You ever think about that? Who decided we could describe all people in terms of mankind? Were you taught in writing classes that it was acceptable, even efficient, and maybe even more than convenient, but even streamlines your work if you just use masculine pronouns to describe everybody? Is people still being taught that? Anybody out there with me still? Has anybody been taught that that's something you need to pay attention to for other reasons? His or her, he or she. Who writes that way by default? Okay. That's progress. Because the assumption is if we can describe all of humanity and write his story, history, conveniently assuming that all of humanity are men, it makes it harder for women to enter traditionally male-dominated professions, among other things. So language not only describes what is, it determines what will be. It determines what will be. The way we use words determines the future. So people that are concerned about inclusive language are not just trying to be politically correct. They're trying to change the world for the better and make it a more egalitarian, inclusive place. And there's a couple readings to that effect. Symbols we've discussed at some length. The whole micro theory lecture on symbolic interactionism, I think, deals with that pretty effectively. I'm just highlighting, again, we have all manners of things that unite us around a common symbol. The flag, certainly, maybe even especially on a day like today. A-OK, thumbs up, that kind of thing. Our automobile is, in some sense, a reflection of who we want to present to others. Anything that we present to others for evaluation, that's a kind of shorthand for what we want to be about. Even something as simple as a wedding ring. Tell somebody else something about us that you can derive some meaning from. So symbols are sort of the kinds of things we present to others. They're the kind of shorthand we use to communicate and understand each other. In a social world, we also have regulations. We have rules. We call them norms, as in normative behavior. They are of three types: folkways, mores, and taboos, and they are of increasing levels of intensity, but I think also decreasing levels of commonality. The most common sets of rules that govern our behavior are the informal ones, the ones that aren't so much written down, the folkways, the things that are standards of politeness, etiquette, clearly understood ways of interacting with one another in a civil and social way. Fair enough? You know, not the kinds of things that are written into laws, which are what mores tend to be, or at least more formalized, if not laws. A folk way. You know, wash behind your ears, flush, you know, don't put your feet on the table, that kind of thing. My favorite way of describing folk ways, however, is using a word that I invented several years ago. I actually did invent a word. You know, I know Apple invented the iWatch, and Al Gore invented the Internet, I guess, or so he says. I invented a word called hat-iquette, hat-iquette, as in hat etiquette, as in when it is or isn't appropriate for men or women, to be wearing a hat here or there. Now, I'm just scanning the room here. I see, you know, a couple dozen guys in the room with hats on their heads, right? How many of you guys that are sitting in the room with a hat on your head right now have someone in your life, your dad, your grandpa, you know, your Uncle Bubba or somebody, who if he were to materialize next to you just right now, the first thing he might say is, get that hat off. And yet, you're wearing your hat, right? Because you're in, and he's going, oh, dang. But, you know, things are different. It's college and all that. And, you know, there are places where hats are appropriate, places that are not. How many of you guys, in fact, let me just invite all just the guys for a minute to imagine that you are wearing a hat right now. Okay. I know that's it. It's probably kind of edgy for some of you, but that's all right. He just took his off. Imagine that you're wearing a hat right now. Would you still have your hat on if you went to lunch today with three friends, male friends, at the student union building? Who would still have their hats on? I mean, all guys can play this game, okay? All right. Let's imagine instead you're having lunch at Chili's across the street with someone you care about more than just casual friends. Just one person that you care about in some sort of deep way. How many still have their hat on? You're at the Texas Tech Club with that same person you care about deeply and that person's grandmother for lunch. Who's still got the hat on? Hell yeah. Get the idea? All right, some of the women in the room have hats on, do they not? For women, the rules are different. For women, a hat is not a hat. It's a fashion accessory, is it not? You know, it's a way of, you got your hair all nicely around it. Yeah, you pay a little attention to it, you know, yeah, as it were. How many of you women, let me just ask all the women now, you get to play now. If you were on an elevator by yourself, okay, imagine you're on an elevator by yourself, just going up wherever you're going. The elevator stops, and a guy gets on the elevator wearing a hat, and he takes it off then just because you're in the elevator with him. Who would faint? Yeah, basically, you know, but you get, you know. I think these rules have become a little slippery over the years, but it's not totally lost on us that there are styles and standards of behavior that, you know, we comply with or don't. Folkways, you know, etiquette, standards of courtesy, maybe decency, distance, that sort of thing. Mores are rules of slightly greater level intensity. They're the ones that have been formulated into laws or have, in one form or another, been written down and regulate our behavior. Traffic laws, certainly any criminal code piece. They change over time. Certainly our understanding of what it means to be pro-life and how that's regulated changes on almost a daily basis, especially in and throughout the South. So these are contested, arguably, through a functional process of negotiation and consensus and all of that. It's really the one that I'm kind of interested or that I've been watching for a very long time are the laws or regulations about cigarette smoking. We used to smoke in class in college. You know, I'd be sitting in the back and put my feet up on the chair in front of me and light up a cigarette so people would leave me alone. Profs all smoked, you know, it was just different. Heck, in my high school, we used to smoke in the bathrooms, and that got to be smelly and dirty. So my high school administration, in its wisdom, decided, well, we can fix that problem. They just put an area in the high school where students who had a note from their moms could light up between classes. Hard to imagine, isn't it? I mean, we're moving toward where whole communities, I mean, New York has done it, Lubbock will likely do it, where there's no place to smoke indoors at all and highly regulated outdoors. So these things change over time. Taboos are essentially mores are the ones, are the regulations that have been written down. And most of these have been formulated into laws or regulations. Taboos are rules, social rules, that are so important that if people were to violate them to any degree at all, the society would crumble. There would be no more culture if any degree what are referred to as taboos were violated. I can only think of two anthropology gives us the notion or the concept of the incest taboo, which is not always thou shalt not have sex with members of your family. It's not always that, it's often that. But the incest taboo refers to the ironclad reality that virtually all culture has some way of regulating with whom and without, with not whom people can engage in sexual activity. So that's called the incest taboo. It's really only one other one that I can think of, and well, it's cannibalism. We'd like to have you for dinner. Oh, yay. Jeffrey Dahmer. Everybody's still, you were probably not even alive, a lot of you, when he died. He was killed in prison by a fellow inmate. Big surprise. He was a serial murderer and consumed, to some extent, some of his victims. It's very creepy. He lived in Milwaukee, like 20 miles from where I grew up. That's creepy, too. And I'm a little vulnerable today, and I just have to confess this to you, that nobody ever asked Dahmer the question I was at least sick enough to be curious about. What do we taste like? Anybody other than me ever wonder that? See, you're all going, ew. That's the intensity of taboo. Okay. Three ways of describing the rules that regulate our life together. Folk ways, for the most part, these are the sorts of things we live with. Mores govern us in a more intense way. Taboos probably don't bother us very much, but they are very clear that there are a couple of things that anyone in any society shall not do. Okay, if there are rules governing behavior in a successful society, there must be ways to both reward and punish the compliance with or violation of these rules. And we call these rewards and punishments, we call them sanctions. They can be both positive and negative. They can be formal. They can be informal. A positive, formal sanction will be the grade you earn on Tuesday's test. Okay? A negative, formal sanction might be the speeding ticket you get trying to get here, or the parking ticket you get trying to park close to a building because it's raining, and you say, what the heck, they won't get me for just as long as, and they might. A positive, informal sanction might be the six-year-old in your life, if you have one, who runs up to you when they haven't seen you for a couple of months because they live in Austin and you live in Lubbock, and you get a great big hug like, ah, I'm so glad to see you, that kind of thing. Positive, informal reward, just for being there and just for being you. Negative, informal sanction, my favorite actually. Some of you did this to me when I asked that question about Dahmer. You went, I got the look, the look. Hello. Anybody given somebody the look already today? Yeah. I mean, other than me. But anybody got plans? Boy, when I see them, they are so going to get the look. Get the. I mean, and that's generally all it takes. Like, and you go, what? And then you get the idea of what, where you stepped in it, how bad it smells, etc. So there are sanctions of a variety of types, positive and negative, formal and informal. Sometimes people are rewarded for breaking a rule that truly needs to go. And for this, I would invite you to read more about the story of Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott in the 1950s in Alabama. Rosa Parks broke a rule. She broke a hated rule. She broke a rule that needed to go. And I'm going to take just a couple of minutes to describe the depth of bus laws and why these laws needed to go. If you were an African American in the South in the 50s and you simply wanted to get on the bus to ride home from work, you had to get on the bus. I mean, buses have front and back doors, right? They still do. You know, on the front of the bus, you had to pay your money, and then you had, because nobody gets on the bus without paying, you have to pay. Then you do a little radar sweep if you're black. And there was a line halfway back beyond which was the quote-unquote black section of the bus. But in the front, if it was not full and if there were not enough white people on the bus so that there were empty seats and space between them, you could, if you were African-American, sit down. And that's what Rosa Parks did. Now, when the bus continues along its way and more white folk get on, it's the bus driver's prerogative, in fact, obligation under these rules, to stop the bus and say, hey, excuse me, ma'am, would you mind moving to the back of the bus, please, because you're black. Well, that's typically not how it went. It was, hey, get to the back of the bus. Get the idea? Well, Rosa Parks had a really crappy job. She cleaned white people's houses. That was her deal. And she'd had a very bad day, and she also had a problem with her feet. Her corns were acting up. Rosa Parks sat up. She said, I'm too tired. My feet are too sore. I'm not moving. I just said no. Bus driver called the police. She was taken off the bus in handcuffs, and it started the Montgomery bus boycott. Now, you should learn one other thing about the way bus rules worked in the South. If you were black and the bus stopped, which it may not, you had to get on the bus at the front door, pay your money, and if you radar sweep, there's no room in the front. I have to sit in the back. You can't walk down the front of down the center aisle. You get too close to white people. That would be icky. You had to get off the bus, go to the back door. And now imagine again, black, Alabama, 1950. Paid the money already, now off the bus. How often do you think by the time you got to the back that bus was still there? Or whether there was any penalty for having a bus driver do that? That's the level of, it's just beyond imagination in lots of ways. The way these rules worked, why they needed to go, and why Rosa Parks is an American hero in many ways. Kicked over one of the first dominoes in the civil rights movement. Sanctions. Values are things that we believe in, things that go beyond, something you can put in your pocket, although you might, put something that's symbolically important in your pocket that connects you to another person. We believe in America in freedom, patriotism, education, religion. We believe in monogamy and romantic love, among other things, which is not especially common. In fact, it's relatively recent in world history. The whole notion of monogamous partnerships driven by falling in love and romance is only about 150 years old. Marriages were typically arranged for purposes of uniting families and sealing social contracts. Now, that's true still in some parts of the world, but romantic love and monogamy are things that are relatively new, and we cherish these things. We value these things. That's what values are. They're things that go beyond what we intend to do in a particular day. They inform why we do what we do in the way that we do them. Fair enough? All right, any questions to this point? Because I'm just going to define a few more terms and then we'll get on with our Rick Perry game. Any questions to this point, then, on how come I can't get beyond this? On what we've done so far. Language, symbols, norms of three types, sanctions, and values. Yeah?
Could you explain a little bit more about a positive formal sanction?
A positive formal sanction. Getting a raise. You've performed well at work, and you get a salary bump. That's formally done, and it's done because you're really good at what you did. That make sense?
Yeah.
Sure. You bet. What else? All right, let me define then some terms. A subculture is a component of a society that lives by a different set of norms, where the norms are different. I guess you could call college students a kind of subculture. Let me ask you this. How many of you, and I don't want to make this overly personal, but you can say you know yourself in this little exercise. How many of you know somebody who, just since they've been at Texas Tech, and we've been here what? Not even a month, right? You have done something. You have engaged in a behavior of some sort that would be out of bounds were you not at Texas Tech and out of view of parents and others. Okay. How many of you know somebody that has had that happen and learned something significant about, whoa, I may not try that again too soon? Yeah, right? Get the idea. Because the rules are different. I mean, they are and they aren't. The surveillance is different. The customs are different. A lot of this has to do with, just sort of growing into an arena where you get to make your own decisions and, in many respects, live with the consequences yourself. Some of it's, often these kinds of things are learnings with regard to alcohol consumption and other things. But you get the idea. There's a kind of differentness about being away at school. And, going back for Thanksgiving break, well, the rules will, they'll shift again and your behavior might change. Totally lost my train of thought. That was just weird. Oh, okay. Another kind of subculture would be members of the military, particularly members of the military, let's say, serving on a submarine. There are necessities of simply staying alive in an underwater tube that require rules with regard to consumption and hygiene and all that kind of thing that are very, very different than if you're not on a submarine somewhere. So that these are just circus performers who travel would be another example of a kind of subculture. Of a different type, countercultures would be groups in a culture that live by not just a different set of rules, but by an oppositional set of rules. Rules that are counter to, or in opposition to, or in conflict with prevailing norms, let's say. Many people, especially in the South, would regard simply being gay or lesbian as a countercultural way of life. Maybe a better example would be these sort of secretive polygamous cults that come out of ancient Mormon tradition and other kinds of things that really go beyond what a civil society can tolerate. There was a commune of this type in Arizona, not too far from here, that was shut down a couple of years ago, and the leader of this polygamist sect was put in jail for abusing young girls, among other things. So, that's countercultural to a level that requires a kind of intervention. Okay, so subcultures are just groups of people that live by a different set of rules. Countercultural realities are those that live by a set of rules that are in opposition to prevailing culture. Ethnocentrism, culture shock, I missed that one. Culture shock is encountering unfamiliar elements of culture. Going to Europe and realizing you really do have to put money in either the plate of the attendant or even in the door of the bathroom stall. Pay toilets in Europe are very common, and you better have a euro or two in your pocket, especially if you feel like I do right now, etc. So, driving on the left-hand side of the road in London, any other place. But there's even elements of culture shock that go, that are apparent when you move to Texas from Wisconsin, among other things. I'd learn a different language at the proper use of y'all. How y'all doing? Then there's plural y'alls. Y'all, that y'alls? Then there's plural possessive. That all y'all's truck? That all y'all's truck? See if you can translate this. This is cheesehead. This is a phrase commonly heard, often to children, in Wisconsin. You ready? Don't you bunch in line at the bubbler. Don't you bunch in line at the bubbler. What the heck does that mean? Anybody got an idea? Yeah?
Don't bunch in line at the water fountain.
Don't crowd the drinking fountain. That's right. Who knew what a bubbler was? Et cetera. This is dumb stuff, right? But you do encounter unfamiliar elements. Maybe just realizing somebody on your dorm floor actually has beer. That's not what? Imagine it. Culture shock, right? I'm sure that's not been the case for anybody in this room. I cast no aspersions. Sure, language is a kind of, you have to sort of get over the shock of having people communicating in a way that you don't get. And by golly, why don't they Why don't they stop? You know, sometimes you hear people coming back from a trip to France, my gosh, three-year-olds speak French over there. What? Ethnocentrism is the belief that your deal is better than everybody else's deal. Ethno, human, centric, my world. That American this, that, or the other thing is superior to others. And again, this notion of cultural diffusion that I mentioned early on makes this a little, you know, it just makes it kind of silly after a while. I mean, what is, in fact, an American car when most of it was built in Mexico, outsourced by Ford? What is a Japanese car when a lot of it was either manufactured or assembled in San Antonio? What's the deal? So there's a lot of slippery boundaries that didn't used to be so. You know, anything that when I was growing up, anything that was quote-unquote made in Japan was seen as terribly inferior. Now, in part, that's because I grew up 10 years after World War II, and the Japanese were the enemy. And Japanese anything was seen as not just inferior, but even unpatriotic. Now, are you kidding me? Cars and electronic equipment, etc.? But that's what ethnocentrism is the belief, the certainty that your way of life is better than others. I'm going to skip one now and go to xenocentrism because it's the opposite of ethnocentrism. And one of these days I'll remember to turn that around on the outline. Xenocentrism is the belief that other people's culture is better than yours. The kind of snobbery that you sometimes see when people start ordering wine in restaurants. Oh, I want the best French wine. Or you can't get wine in America that can compete with the Italians or whatever. So it's the understanding or the belief that other people's stuff is better than yours. And finally, this notion of cultural relativism. You know, people in other parts of the world live in very weird ways, right? And yet, a cultural relativist would have to say, you know, I guess if I lived there and was a part of that history and culture, I might understand it better. You know, that's the value of traveling to other countries. I think there are limits, quite frankly. You know, I just simply can't get the notion of a kind of religious extremism that that validates the killing of people and the torturing of people and the terrorizing of people. I don't get that. There's no way to be relative about that in my view. On the other hand, there are Muslim theocracies, there are countries that are Islamic by tradition and law that have a way of life that if you, and I'm not talking about, you know, the extremist sections and factions in places that are blowing up. I'm talking about the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates or other places where you go, okay, maybe I wouldn't want to live there, but I understand why they live like they do there. That's cultural relativism. I understand why they live like they do there. Fair enough? Okay. Let me ask at this point one more time, do you have any questions about any term I've defined, because we're going to do Rick Perry here in a minute. Okay. Any questions about anything to this point? Okay, here's what I want you to do. Let's just get this out of the way. I want you to take out a sheet of paper. And I simply want you to write your name on it, today's date, which is September 11th, an easy date to remember, and just the words, one hen, two ducks. That's all you got to write. Your name, the date, one hen, two ducks, okay? Take out a sheet of paper. Write your name. Shh, I can't yell. I seriously can't yell over the top of you. Some people didn't get it. Name, today's date, which is 9/11, and one hen, two ducks. Just write that. Okay. Now comes the fun part. We have up on the screen the announcer's test. Now, I said on Tuesday that I would randomly generate a list of names and call on somebody, but I didn't, and I'm tired. So if anybody would, you've got it memorized, right? Okay, we'll get to that in a minute. I just want somebody to stand up and read it, the easy part. Anybody want to just do that? Just stand up and read it where you are? Yeah, everybody in the house gets 2 points if you stand up and read it. Can you do that? Okay. tell everybody your name.
Kaylee.
Kaylee. Okay, everybody listen. So all you have to do is read it. Ready? Go. Ooh, okay. Now, did she make it with 70% accuracy? Who would say yes? Okay, very good. 70 or better, I shouldn't say that. 70% is the gold standard for excellence in the United States. Okay, now, at least one person has said, come on down, that they want to be a hero and turn around. And anybody else that's memorized this, come on down and join the choir if you'd like to be a hero. Anybody else? Come on down. Okay, there you go. Come on up. Yep. Okay, now you have to face that way. Okay, here we go. I will say 1, 2, 3, go, and then you can do it. Are you ready? Oh, first of all, who are you? You are?
Kyle.
Hi, Kyle.
I'm Chad.
Chad?
Brittany,
nice to see you. You ready? 1, 2, 3.
One duck. Oh.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. They meant to do that, I could tell. Okay, you ready? 1, 2, 3.
One hen, 2 ducks, 3 squawking geese, 4 littering oysters, 5 corpulent porpoises, 6 pairs of Don Alvaro's tweezers, 7,000 Macedonians in full battle array, 8 brass monkeys from the ancient sacred crypts of Egypt, 9 apathetic, sympathetic, all men on roller skates who have a marked propensity towards procrastination and sloth. 10 lyrical, spherical, diabolical denizens of the day. Who haul stall around the corner of the quo, of the quay, of the quivery, all at the same time.
Woohoo! Thank you all. I appreciate that. That's good. Okay, here's the deal. Everybody's going to get 4 points on this, which is great. But I'm in a serious sort of way, simply paying attention to this and understanding how important communication is and taking the risk to try to communicate in a way that I do all the time, but it's way harder than it looks, isn't it? Once you get down here, you turn around and go, oh. It's a lot harder than it looks. It's a skill that's worth developing. All right, one last thing. I sent you an email 45 minutes ago that has all the details about the test. On Tuesday, Scantron, orange Scantron, number 2 pencil, and R number, and make up a 4-digit code because that's how we'll post your scores. There's a review on Monday at 6 o'clock in the chemistry building. If you have further questions, I'll answer them or try to at the start of class Tuesday. Thank you very much. I'll be in my office if anybody needs to see me. These go up on the tables.